Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, joining you once again to take an updated look at perhaps the most infamous and controversial case in recent true crime history, which is the murder of 6-year-old JonBenet Ramsey in December 1996. This is a case I covered in my first episode, but I've received a lot of requests to revisit the evidence in a series format, so let's take a look. Of course, the drama begins at approximately 5:52 a.m. on the morning of December 26, 1996, in Boulder, Colorado, when a woman named Patsy Ramsey, 3 days shy of her 40th birthday, calls 911 emergency services, frantic and out of breath, to report that her young daughter JonBenet has been kidnapped from the family's home. The only clues to JonBenet's whereabouts and who took her are documented in a ransom note left at the base of a spiral stairwell near the kitchen where Patsy made the 911 call. The call was received by Kimberly Archuleta, a 911 dispatcher who worked the overnight shift and was only minutes away from clocking out that morning. She would later comment in an interview with NBC, quote, "That's been the hardest call I ever took. I think it's because there was something inside me that said, something's not right," end quote. So let's now listen to the audio of the call and then try to assess what made her feel like that.
911 emergency.
I'm with you. Police.
What's going on?
515th Street.
What's going on there, ma'am?
We have a kidnapping. Hurry, please.
Explain to me what's going on, okay?
There, we have a... There's a note left and our daughter's gone.
A note was left and your daughter is gone? How old is your daughter?
6 years old. She's gone. 6 years old.
How long ago was it?
I don't know. I just found the note. And my daughter's gone.
Does it say who took her?
What?
Does it say who took her?
No, I don't know. There's a ransom note here.
It's a ransom note?
It says FBTC. Victory. Please.
Okay, what's your name? Are you
Patsy Ramsey? I'm the mother. Oh my God! Please.
I'm sending an officer over. Okay.
Please.
Do you know how long she's been gone?
No, I don't. Please, we just got out, and she ran here. Oh my God! Please.
Okay.
Please, there's somebody.
I am, honey.
Please.
Take a deep breath.
Please.
Me, okay?
Hurry.
Patsy.
Okay, so on the surface, we have a very straightforward 911 call. A crime is being reported, specifically a kidnapping, and a parent of the missing child is now desperately asking for assistance from the police. Now, we're going to proceed with analyzing the call to uncover the deeper meanings here. To start, humans use both nonverbal and verbal forms of communication, nonverbal in the sense of movement, such as facial and body expressions, often using the limbs and their extremities, along with the eyes and mouth, among other considerations, to tell a story, or perhaps enhance the meaning or feeling associated with it. For this reason, meaning that the use of words came subsequent to our expression of nonverbal cues in our evolutionary process, we often communicate openly with words that disguise meaning revealed through other sources, specifically the concept of subtext. Subtext, of course, is exactly what it sounds like. It is implied meaning beneath explicit speech or written words. The emergence of the modern human from our hominid predecessors arguably dates back about 300,000 years. Yet verbal forms of communication, or language, were instituted about 100 to 150,000 years ago, leaving us with the reality that we have only been verbally expressive for half of our existence at best. The world, in its most primitive form, is a predator versus prey equation of survival based in action, one in which words, or the expression of language, isn't even remotely necessary. However, as we evolved, specifically in the form of creating civilizations in which nonviolent behaviors were increasingly common, action was forced to give way to spoken forms of negotiation or compromise until the point at which those efforts failed and we were forced to regress to the nonverbal form of expression, meaning action, violence, or war. Now, as civilizations formed and the exchange of goods and services flourished by way of compromise and greater use of expression by way of language, it was still necessary to implement the idea of me versus you and us versus them. However, whereas the art of being predatory in the context of violence involved physical deception or not being seen or realized for your intentions to kill, making the pathway to the predator getting what it wanted one of ease and low risk, that same deception had to be applied to written and spoken language when we evolved, and for the same reasons. Like the predator seeking to kill and wanting to disguise his intentions to get what he truly wants, civilized society, in the absence of taking such things by force, was left to adopt a system of deception as well, one that affected all interactions, from business to the pursuit of love to politics and so on. We used language to disguise what we truly wanted in order to assume the least risk and greatest chance of reward, just as the predator did in making an approach on its prey. Therefore, speech, which starts as a means of elaborating upon that which couldn't be expressly stated through action, evolved along with societal considerations to become something that protected our primal intentions in civilized situations. Today, it is common to say one thing and mean another, as speaking directly could compromise getting what you want. Just as the predator sought to disguise or camouflage its intentions until what it wanted was in its grasp, without compromising the outcome, we too employ that same methodology through written and spoken language. So in this 911 call, we could easily suggest that what is communicated on the surface is genuine, but if we peel back the outer layer of what is said by examining the result of the predator's actions in the form of the kidnapper, we are more able to derive subtext that lies beneath the words. Now, let's go through line by line in an effort to ask one thing. What does Patsy Ramsey really want? And is that consistent with her stated intentions? Kim Archuleta speaks first with 911 emergency. Patsy replies with one word, police. Kim inquires, what's going on there, ma'am? Patsy urgently replies with the home's address, 755 15th Street. Now, we could just say Patsy is in a state of shock, having just discovered her daughter is missing and has seemingly been kidnapped. But if that's the case, then the foremost thought of importance for Patsy should be exactly that. However, it's not. She is focused solely on the home right now, specifically in the context of getting the police to come there. Of course, if her daughter is missing and has been taken from the home, with the kidnapper not having left knowledge of her whereabouts in the text of the ransom note, then it stands to reason the most important aspect of the interaction is getting the police to either search for the child or be on the lookout for her outside the home, contrary to what Patsy is demanding. Let's see if this theme continues. Kim repeats the question, what's going on there, ma'am? Patsy says, we have a kidnapping. Hurry, please. Patsy approaches this subject in a very passive way. She vaguely states, we have a kidnapping, rather than something more coherent and concise, such as, my daughter JonBenet has been kidnapped. She immediately follows that up with, hurry, please. This once again places the utmost importance upon the home, contrary to what should be the subject of greatest importance in a child abduction, which is the location of the kid outside the home. The singular goal here should be to recover Jean-Benet from her current location outside the home. So while it is necessary to examine the crime scene for clues, it is a statistical fact that every minute that passes after a child has been abducted takes the reality of the situation rapidly toward one in which it is less likely the kid will be recovered alive or at all. Kim Archuleta knows better and is once again insistent on understanding what is happening by requesting the following. Explain to me what is going on, okay? Patsy replies first with a broken statement, saying the phrase, "We have a..." She stops there. Now the words, "We have a..." indicate possession, which is correct in the sense that they have the ransom note in their possession. Yet Patsy decides to reverse course on that active assertion for one much more passive and lacking the aspect of possession. She immediately follows up with, "There's a note left, and our daughter's gone." Notice that the change from the phrase, "We have a," in relation to possession of the ransom note, to one of, "There's a note left," distances Patsy from the note in one specific way, which, as I said, is possession. She wants to make clear it is not hers by disconnecting from any relationship to it. Furthermore, she extracts the presence of a kidnapper, specifically in the form of the person who wrote the ransom note and left it at the base of her stairs by saying, "There's a note left," and even follows suit with that same strategy by stating, "And our daughter's gone." Those words extract the main subject of the discourse here in the form of the unknown abductor. Notice that it means, in the context of her words, thematically, there is no kidnapper. Before mentioning the ransom note, she was willing to use the word kidnapping by saying the passive, "We have a kidnapping." But as soon as the note becomes included in the conversation, she removes the subject of the interaction from both the ransom note and the kidnapping. While we are unaware of the specifics in the call, what we understand is that there is something about the inclusion of the ransom note causing her to distance herself or anyone from it by using passive language that denies a subject. Kim replies with a question to confirm, seemingly attempting to get Patsy to elaborate upon her assertion of a note being left. She asks, "A note was left and your daughter is gone?" Patsy simply says, "Yes," and denies Kim further details that might assist. Kim follows with, "How old is your daughter?" Of course, context is important here. There are significant differences between the disappearance of a small child and one who is a teen. That is likely the reasoning for Kim first asking the age, as she might want to distinguish between a situation involving the abduction of a small child and one involving a potential runaway. Patsy replies, "She's 6 years old. She's blonde. 6 years old." Now, Patsy answers the question directly, but then decides that what would be the next most important identifying detail regarding her daughter would be blonde hair and not her name. In fact, even after stating the little girl has blonde hair, Patsy declines offering any further method of identification. Even by the end of the call, she will never have said her daughter's name. Now, imagine the 911 dispatcher alerting local authorities of this kidnapping, and an officer sees a little girl, approximately 6 years of age, with blonde hair, accompanied by an adult in public. That would be a very common occurrence, as plenty of little girls have blonde hair. To the contrary, given that Jean-Benet's name is derived from a combination of her father's first and middle names, John Bennett, it stands to reason the likelihood another little girl in the area shares that name is nearly non-existent. Now, what do we know to be the truth about Jean-Benet in this moment? She is actually dead, and therefore couldn't respond to her name if approached by an officer, So her name is, in fact, irrelevant for the purpose of identifying her outside the home in the company of a stranger. Yet, if, as we later understand to be true, she is dead inside the home and is discovered that way, what will be her remaining identifying characteristics? Quite simply, if the police find her dead within the home, they are absolutely going to see a 6-year-old little girl who has blonde hair. So, on a subconscious level, Patsy is employing only the relevant details to how JonBenet is actually going to be found, and not those that would be essential to use in the context of an abduction outside the family's home. The 911 dispatcher responds by asking, "How long ago was this?" Patsy says, "I don't know. I just got the note and my daughter's gone." Patsy has now mentioned the note multiple times, yet she has decided each time to not provide details regarding the content of the note. Given that we're going to learn that the kidnapper states in the note that JonBenet will be killed if the family contacts law enforcement and is monitoring them, it is awfully strange that Patsy is begging for the police to immediately come to her home without initially divulging that detail. It would make much more sense to contact law enforcement discreetly and proceed to arrange a meeting in a manner conducive to keeping JonBenet safe by way of appearing to abide the terms in the note. If she's already been taken from the home by force, then one has no reason to disbelieve the threats. So, why isn't she concerned? She will later acknowledge having read the note prior to this call. And even by the end of this call, we will have confirmation that she read the text to the end of the note. So why is there total disregard for her daughter's safety through this plain disobedience? Of course, Patsy has had no issue hearing 911 dispatcher Kim Archuleta to this point. But as soon as Kim asks, "Does it say who took her?" Patsy feigns ignorance and asks, "What?" Kim simply repeats the question. Patsy emphatically says no, and then immediately follows up by amending that response to, "I don't know." Yet even though the identity of the perpetrators is generalized in the note for the purpose of concealing their full identity in the context of a crime, the note does in fact, in the first paragraph, state that the kidnappers are a small group of individuals who represent a foreign faction. Instead of allowing the operator access to that information, Patsy says, "There's a ransom note here." Kim confirms by asking, "It's a ransom note?" Now, perhaps Kim should have directly asked for further detail instead of implying she wanted it. But it's nonetheless fairly obvious she is asking Patsy to qualify the assertion. However, Patsy decides to skip over the entirety of the ransom note's content and proceed to reveal how it is signed at the end, SBTC Victory. Before Kim can respond, Patsy urges once again with pleas, giving us another desperate attempt at getting the police to come to the home. There is no effort to say anything like, "Please get out there and find her," and certainly no effort at making the operator aware of the content of the note she skipped over, in which the kidnapper threatens to kill JonBenet if they contact authorities. The specific threat in question is a beheading. So even under the threat of her 6-year-old daughter's head being chopped off, Patsy vehemently demands the police immediately and without discretion create a circumstance in which it will be revealed the Ramseys disobeyed the note. Now, not only has Patsy failed to identify her daughter, she's even failed to identify herself. So Kim asks her name. She says Patsy Ramsey, but still doesn't think to offer her missing daughter's name. After saying her own name, she oddly amends that information with, "I'm the mother." She doesn't say, "I'm her mother," or "I'm JonBenet's mother." She says, "I'm the mother." which speaks to the nature of a role she's playing rather than a relationship. For instance, if you were an actor in a sitcom, or any type of drama for that matter, documenting the daily life of a family, I might ask, "What role do you play?" And you might respond, "I'm the mother." But in terms of relationships to family members, we are far more likely to say, "I'm her mother," or "She's my daughter." So in a sense, Patsy, having not mentioned her daughter's name, is concerned about the role she's playing in the drama that is unfolding, which is consistent with a work of fiction. After expressing, "I'm the mother," Patsy proceeds with, "Oh my God, please," again urging the dispatcher to get the police to her home. While it is obviously normal to behave with such urgency, her unwillingness to divulge pertinent information suggests she wants the police to come and rely on what they see and not be informed prior to arrival by what she says. Her child is both nameless and under the threat of execution at this time, yet Patsy shows no regard whatsoever for her identity or her safety. Why? Kim replies, "Okay, I'm sending an officer over, okay?" Patsy, however, asks again with, "Please." Kim asks a very important question at this point. "Do you know how long she's been gone?" Patsy replies, "No, I don't. Please." She makes another urgent cry for the police to come to her home, and as she is asked more questions that are obviously both relevant and necessary for the police to accurately assess the situation, she tries harder and more desperately to not answer them. Patsy follows with, "We just got up and she's not here. Oh my God, please." The focal point of this call remains the family's home, and not their daughter or her circumstances. We don't know her name, nor do we know that the writer of the ransom note has threatened execution for making such a call as the one Patsy is currently indulging in a reckless manner. Kim tries to ask Patsy to calm down, but is interrupted with, "Please send somebody, please." Patsy has no intention other than getting authorities to the home. The only circumstance in which that makes sense is one in which the threat of execution is not real and their daughter is not actually missing. If law enforcement comes to the home, it is a fact nobody is going to proceed to execute JonBenet. She's already dead. It's also a fact that she cannot respond to her name, for the same reasons. But she will be identified by being a 6-year-old girl with blonde hair. And so in this call, Patsy subconsciously focuses on that. In this circumstance, retrospect allows us insight into the subtext here. If you decline the inclusion of that retrospect, then the call simply stands as a desperate, panicked mother who needs help because her kid was abducted. As Patsy continues to request that Kim send someone, meaning a cop, to the home, Kim reassures her with, "I am, honey." Patsy, however, says please once again, as she is focused only on police coming to her home. Kim says, "Take a deep breath," and Patsy interrupts with, "Hurry, hurry, hurry." She desperately wants the one thing that explicitly promises to get her daughter killed in the ransom note. Her state of hysteria and cries of please and hurry escalate in an effort to say nothing else of substance to the 911 dispatcher, Kim Archuleta, and at this point, knowing that an officer is being sent to the home, we all know what happens next on a 911 call. The operator is going to ask more questions and try to substantiate anything relevant to the circumstances. However, without being prompted by the operator, Patsy proceeds to hang up. Or so she thinks. This is the era of landlines, and she's on a wall phone, so we're not talking about pressing a button on a screen. She needs to put the receiver itself back into the cradle where the button is located. but somehow it goes in askew, and the call doesn't end. In this moment, Kim tries to get Patsy to stay on the line, repeating her name over and over in question form. Patsy, however, doesn't return to the call. Yet Kim has the awareness that the call hasn't ended and remains on the line to listen. And this is where the call becomes quite controversial. According to Kim, she immediately heard Patsy Ramsey say something to the effect of, "Okay, we've called the police. Now what?" Of course, the receiver was no longer in front of Patsy's mouth, leading to the words becoming difficult to comprehend in relation to what Patsy had said before hanging up. What stood out to Kim the most, though, is that she had noticed that Patsy's tone was distinctly different than when the two had interacted directly moments earlier, meaning the panic and hysteria were gone. We aren't privileged to a level of clarity at the end of the call that Kim had, however, because we need to rely on the quality of the recording rather than the call itself. Most audio recording devices in late 1996 generally did not offer the level of clarity you might be afforded by similar technology today. So whereas we don't necessarily hear Patsy make such an assertion in the recording, it very well might have been apparent for Kim. Archuleta believed to have heard conversation beyond that moment, involving others in Patsy's presence, and to the best of her recognition, believed she had heard at least two, if not three, voices in the discussion. Kim proceeded to report this occurrence to her supervisor, which ultimately led to a chain of events in which the audio would be heavily scrutinized. Local law enforcement soon realized they weren't properly equipped to perform adequate analysis of the recording, and subsequently sent the evidence to both the Secret Service and FBI. There are conflicting stories as to why they were unable to decipher the audio on a deeper level, but in the aftermath of those attempts, the audio was sent to Aerospace Corporation in Los Angeles, where revolutionary technology could help. Law enforcement worked with the engineers at Aerospace and were able to produce a digitally enhanced copy of the audio in order to bring greater clarity and distinction to the background voices at the end of the call. Their first conclusion was that there were three distinct voices present, which was problematic because Patsy and John have always claimed Burke was asleep upstairs at the time of the 911 call. As they were the only three living people in the home at that time, by default of this information, it would seem both Patsy and John lied. Burke had been present after all. Multiple people doing the audio enhancement were then able to focus on distinguishing the words that were spoken, which led to the following consensus. There were three different voices on the audio, they claim. An adult male voice says, in an angry, authoritative tone, "We're not speaking to you." An adult female voice says, "Help me, Jesus, help me, Jesus." On a side note, some argue she says, "What did you do? What did you do?" At first glance, those words are vastly different, but actually contain the same number of syllables, which is likely the reason for the discrepancy between the two. A young male, or boy, then says, "Well, what did you find?" with emphasis on the word "did." While the Ramseys vehemently denied Burke was present, supposedly he was confronted with the audio in front of the grand jury and asked if the voice sounded like his own, to which he replied, "Yes." Furthermore, even though the Ramseys claimed Burke was also still asleep when the police arrived at the home and began their search, they later recanted that assertion when Burke admitted he was actually awake inside his bedroom. They were forced to reverse course because Burke surprised them by testifying to the grand jury that he had, in fact, been awake. So we know Burke was awake, and if a boy's voice was heard on the recording of the 911 call, and the trio of Ramseys were the only people in the house, the only conclusion to be drawn from the evidence is that Burke was present during the 911 call. However, his parents remained steadfast in their denial, despite Burke admitting to a grand jury that the boy's voice on the call sounded like his own. So clearly, there is at least some deception by the parents in relation to both their son's presence and knowledge. Why? In this call, we have a kidnapping being reported, one that is confirmed only by documentation in the form of a ransom note. But in totality, by way of analysis, we can establish three elements that are present here. 1. The police coming to the home is perceived to be far more important than looking for JonBenet elsewhere or even knowing her identity. 2. The excessive and explicit threats of death for contacting law enforcement were ignored. The Ramseys exercised no discretion in their contact with authorities, failing to even mention those threats. 3. The Ramseys seem to have misled the police regarding their son's situational awareness and presence during and after the 911 call. While we can't derive a definitive conclusion from that information, it suggests three prevailing notions about what this information could mean. 1. JonBenet is not outside the house. 2. JonBenet's identity and safety aren't important because any threats on her life and identifying her by name would be irrelevant if she was dead. 3. There is a persistent effort to present Burke as being completely ignorant of the circumstances at hand, thus distancing him from them. In totality, if JonBenet is in the house and dead, as we later learn to be the truth, then what conclusion would we be left to draw about why her 8-year-old brother Burke would require his parents employing deception in relation to his knowledge of the situation and whereabouts during the call? Thematically, it suggests that they want to express the following idea. Burke doesn't know anything about what happened to his sister JonBenet. Yet, if that was true, then what reason would there be for such pretense? His ignorance, if genuine, could easily be established by law enforcement through questioning. However, the Ramseys seem to want to preclude any such questioning through assertions of complete ignorance. So, for now, these are just elements to consider and ask ourselves, why? The last thing to consider on this front would be the probability that confirmation bias might come into play for listeners of this audio, as seemed to be the case when a 2016 CBS show analyzing the murder asserted their results to be a product of their own investigative measures to decipher the voices, yet, in actuality, they had simply adopted the conclusions of the 1997 Aerospace Corporation engineers verbatim. Many people are not able to conclusively decide with any degree of accuracy what is being said at the end of the 911 call recording. But what is more easily ascertained is that there are multiple voices present, and it seems to be three. John, Patsy, and Burke were reportedly the only people in the house, and for that reason, we're unable to attribute the voices to other people. In that light, I'll just refrain from analyzing the content due to indecipherability. Okay, let's wrap this up here, and I'll be back soon for part two. In the meantime, take a look at the YouTube link I provided in the show notes. Clicking it will take you to the animated video I made as a trailer for a new true crime show I'm developing, one that was made possible by the generosity of listeners like you. I haven't had a chance to promote it yet, so it's hardly been seen by anybody to this point. If you enjoy it, maybe give it a like and subscribe, as I'm hoping to have more video content in the near future. And as always, thanks for listening. Until next time, my friends.